The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Andy Ehrlich, and I'm privileged to serve on the Foundation Board of the Free Library. I am really especially honored to welcome you tonight because this is a very special lecture. This is the Mila Gordon Memorial Lecture. Ms. Gordon was the mother of our very dear chairperson of the Foundation Board of Directors, Toby Dichter, who is at this moment halfway across the world, or believe me, she would be here with us tonight. While I did not know Mila Gordon personally, Toby has spoken so often of her mother's complete dedication to the business education of women and her personal, very close dedication to this institution. She instilled leadership skills in her own daughters and countless other young women. She understood that the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity, from its award-winning author event series to the thought-provoking programs and life-changing resources for all ages. Now to this exciting evening with Arianna Huffington. As you probably know, she is co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. She is really a global media mogul. She's recognized worldwide. And in 2011, she was named as one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People and the 2014 Forbes World 100 Most Powerful Women's List. In short, she is a thought leader who is brave enough to change her views and political philosophies as the times demand, and she's flexible enough to communicate via the written word as the author of more than a dozen books, through the digital divide of the blogosphere, and as a sought-after journalist and commentator on television and streaming media. Tonight, she will definitely discuss her new book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. There, she delves into the sleep movement that is taking hold all across the world. But this woman of so many intellectual interests, well, I just kind of think that she may well be persuaded to delve into a variety of other subjects in her talk tonight, in conversation with journalist Tracy Matysak. We are so lucky to have them here with us this evening. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Arianna Huffington and Tracy Matysak to the Free Library. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. So happy to see so many of you on a rather soggy Friday evening, but obviously that didn't keep you away. So we're thrilled that you're here, and we're thrilled to have Arianna Huffington with us tonight. So let's start with this question. How did you sleep last night?
I actually slept relatively well, considering that I have to tell you a story. On Sunday, I was coming back from Washington, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and in the car was my daughter and my chief of staff, and we're saying how this tour has gone so great, and, the colleges are responding to the sleep message, and it's been fantastic. And I get out of the car, and I open the door to the street, to my apartment building, and the door, with a very, very sharp edge, hits my foot in the middle of the vein, and this incredible sort of amazing amount of blood keeps spurting out, and have to go to the emergency and get 5 stitches. And I thought, You know, there's this funny moment when you think everything is going great and then this freakish accident happens. So if I'm sit down, I'm so happy that I'm not speaking standing, but I'm here because the minute I stand, it balloons.
Oh.
But despite that, I actually slept well, and the main reason is because I now have a transition ritual to sleep. And earlier I was talking to some of you about how sleeping difficulties, and I promise you that if you follow a transition ritual to sleep, it changes everything. Those of you who are parents know that when we have a baby or a young child, we never just drop it into bed. We actually have a whole ritual, right? We give it a bath, we put it in its PJs, we sing it a lullaby. But when we grow up, we stop doing that to ourselves. And that's, I think, part of what we need to rediscover.
So what's your ritual?
So my ritual starts half an hour before I'm going to turn off the lights. But I recommend to start even with 5 minutes. You know, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Just start with something. Can you all hear me? Because you have to deal with my accent. So I turn off all my devices 30 minutes before I'm going to go to sleep and gently escort them out of my bedroom. That is critical. That is the non-negotiable part of the ritual. Everything else I'm going to say, you can adjust to what works for you. But the first part cannot be adjusted. I recognize the gentleman in the third row is not happy with that. But I promise you, you're going to feel so much better in the morning when you've got a good night's sleep. The reason for that is that we are all a little addicted to our devices. And so if we wake up in the middle of the night and our phone is charging by our bed, we are very likely to pick it up, even with the best intentions. We'll pick it up because we are not going right back to sleep. We are bored, so we want to be distracted by looking at our texts, our emails, our social media. So anyway, that's the first step. The second, for me, is having a hot bath with Epsom salts and flickering candles. Now, you guys can skip the flickering candles and have a shower. But the point is that there is something about water which is like a purification ritual, kind of washing the day away. Because every day, even in the happiest of lives, has a mixture of good things, bad things, incompletions, challenges. We have to have a clear demarcation line. You know, a moment when we say, the day is done. And this is now my time to sleep and recharge and return to the day with fresh eyes and fresh energy in the morning. So I find that a key part of my ritual. And also I love the fact that I can rekindle my romance with sleep. Because, you know, people have turned sleep into something that should be avoided at all cost, that we should minimize. It's like a heavily mined border that we should not cross, if possible. And we need to change our minds about it based on all the latest science. And so water helps. And then after that, I used to sleep in the same sweatpants, etc., that I wore to the gym. Not literally the ones I wore that day, but you get the idea. And what happened is that my brain was getting these mixed messages. Are we going to work out or are we going to sleep? So now I have dedicated sleep clothes, night dresses, PJs, you know, just things that I only wear to sleep. And when I get into bed, I only read physical books. Never anything on a screen. Even if it's an e-reader. You know, the e-reader doesn't have the same blue light, but it's not the same feeling. I like the tactile feeling of holding a book. And you know, you get that drowsy feeling, and then you can just let it drop on the floor. You wouldn't do that to your Kindle. And I have to say that if you are reading The Sleep Revolution, it puts you to sleep, I will consider it a personal victory.
You know, it's been a success. So we know you for your work in journalism and politics, all that you've done to bring the Huffington Post to where it is. But you had a fairly scary experience. You were talking about painful, bloody accidents a moment ago. You had a pretty scary experience
really
got you, to thinking about this whole idea of sleep.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a painful wake-up call, which is how I've become the sleep evangelist, which was 9 years ago. I collapsed from sleep deprivation and hit my head on my way down and broke my cheekbone. And in the course of re-looking at my life and re-evaluating how I was living my life, I really had to reach the conclusion that it wasn't just me, that millions of people are burnt out. In fact, the book, The Sleep Revolution, is dedicated to all those who are sick and tired of being sick and tired. As I had become, like I was like the kind of person sleepwalking through life, never getting enough sleep because I felt I had so much to juggle, and as a result, compromising my health, my decision making, and my happiness. And now, what is amazing, and why I'm so excited about this particular moment we're living through, is that the science, the new science of sleep, is so conclusive. You know, Tracy, because you've read the book, that I have 50 pages of scientific endnotes accompanying the science chapter. Now, you don't have to read the endnotes, but I want them to be there to convince even the most stubborn skeptic that we have gotten it wrong about sleep. Since the Industrial Revolution, we started devaluing it, especially men. Although I'm sure none of the enlightened men here, but men started wearing sleep deprivation like a badge of honor, you know, bragging about how little sleep they need. I mean, I actually had dinner with a guy recently who bragged that he had only gotten 4 hours sleep the night before, and I thought to myself, I didn't say it, but I thought to myself, you know what, if you'd gotten five, this dinner would have been a lot more interesting. So we need to change all that. And all the evidence now is so conclusive that sleep is a performance enhancer. Yeah. And that's why you have athletes now who are prioritizing their sleep. Not because of any other reason, but because it makes it more likely they're going to win on the court or in the field.
How sleep-deprived are we as a nation?
Well, we are very sleep deprived. About 40% of us are very sleep deprived. And let's just make it very clear what that means. There is a universal scientific consensus that unless you are one of the tiny percentage, about 1% of us, who are known as short sleepers, meaning they can do great on 4 to 5 hours, and if you are one of them, you will know, because you can get 4 hours sleep and feel great in the morning. It's not like, and if you're not sure, you can get yourself tested. But it's a genetic mutation. You cannot train yourself to have a genetic mutation. So the rest of us need 7 to 9 hours to be at peak performance. Like where you are in the 7 to 9 spectrum is individual. I'm at 8. If I get 8, I feel great. You know that feeling of feeling on top of the world? Bring it on. Whatever the challenges, I can handle them. I don't get affected. If I get 4, 5, 6, everything about my life is degraded. Also, I kind of become the kind of person I don't like to be around. Like moody, reactive, irritable. You know the type? And the reason now why I have kept to my 8 hours 95% of the time is because of how much I love showing up in life fully present and fully alert and actually enjoying my life, because I find that sleep deprivation robs us of joy as well as robbing us of health and good decision making.
We were talking backstage about how for so many of us, on those rare occasions when we do get enough sleep, the difference is amazing, how you think to yourself, so this is how I'm supposed to feel.
Yeah.
So what are the health risks associated with not getting enough sleep?
So the health risks are very considerable. Let's start with the most immediate and obvious, which is when we're sleep deprived, our immune system is suppressed. So we're more likely to catch a cold, more likely to get the flu, more likely to be affected by all the thousands of viruses that are surrounding us all the time but don't affect us all equally. But beyond that, it affects stress dramatically and therefore affects hypertension and heart disease. It affects obesity and diabetes. It starts with the fact that when you are sleep deprived, you are going to crave carbs and sugar. So what is surprising is that we have kind of convinced the world, whether we do it or not, that nutrition and exercise are important. But the third leg of the stool, the third pillar, is sleep. So if you're going to put your alarm early on to wake up before you've had your full night's sleep to go to the gym, don't. Sleep in. Because basically a lot of people go to the gym to lose weight or to maintain weight. And the truth is that it's much, much harder if you do that when you're sleep deprived. And on top of it, last year we had an enormous amount of casualties of type A men who feel they have to go work out when they're exhausted and they've collapsed on their treadmills. I don't know if you've been following that. The CEO of United collapsing with a massive heart attack. The head of M&A at JP Morgan collapsing and dying on his treadmill. So we are missing out on the absolute essential nature of sleep for the recovery and the regeneration of our cells and our body. And then let's get to our brain. We used to think that sleep is a time of inactivity. They used to say it's like putting the car in the garage and turning the ignition key off. Well, now we know that actually it's a time of frenetic activity in the brain. It's a time when the plumbing system of the brain, the glymphatic system as they call it, is cleaning up all the accumulated toxins of the day. Because the brain has two modes, either awake and alert or asleep and cleaning up. And if you don't clean up, what happens is what happens if you are entertaining the guests all the time and you don't clean up the house. All that junk accumulates between the brain cells and it leads to memory loss and ultimately Alzheimer's. So you see now the connection between the sleep epidemic and the Alzheimer's epidemic. Mm. So this is not to scare anybody because after all, sleep is here, available and free. And all we have to do is actually change our minds about its importance and then change some of our habits. And there are so many natural ways to do that. It's just like a whole cornucopia of natural ways to get enough sleep. And the first half of the book, as you know, Tracy, is about the crisis, the science, the history, and the mystery in terms of dreams. And the second part is all the tips and techniques and any amount of information that you can tailor to your life and to yourself to get the sleep you need.
But is it a tough sell, Ariana, because we live in a culture, as you've pointed out, that thinks that it's a badge of honor to not get enough sleep, to brag that, well, I only had 4 hours sleep last night and I'm running on fumes. So is it a tough sell to convince people to move away from that and to get the sleep they need?
Less and less so. I think we're in a period of transition and you have an enormous amount of cultural shifts happening, which start with athletes. I mention athletes first because, after all, they're all about performance. And so when athletes prioritize their sleep, it's a very powerful message to other leaders. In workplaces, a lot of companies now have recognized that it makes a difference not just to the health of employees, but to the health of the bottom line because it affects healthcare costs and productivity. And just to give you an example of these changes are happening all the time, and something that happened after my book went to press, so it's not in the book, but it's fascinating, it's a real tipping point, is that Aetna, which is the third largest health insurance company, has just introduced from the top, from Mark Bertolini, the CEO, a program where they give all their employees Fitbits to track their sleep, and the ones who opt into the program and get 7 hours or more a night get $25 a night. Wow. Now, remember, it's not just the financial reward. It's the fact that a major public company has done the calculations that when their employees get enough sleep, it's better for the bottom line and it's better for the shareholders. That is a tipping point. Yes. Because another tipping point is McKinsey, the consulting firm, which you might think is the boiler room of burnout, has just put out a paper which was extracted in the Harvard Business Review, and the title is The Proven Link Between Effective Leadership and Sleep. And it's all about how when you're sleep deprived, the prefrontal cortex where decisions are made and leadership qualities are housed is degraded. Mm. So all that is happening, and so it's affecting workplaces, it's affecting colleges. You know, we've done this big tour. It's now going to be soon 150 colleges. I didn't go to all of them, but we've taken sleep fairs to raise awareness among college students about the importance of sleep for their grades, for their social life, and for their mood and happiness. Hotels, it's become like the new competitive advantage. Which hotel can provide the better sleep experience? It used to be which hotel can provide the best bar. But now people realize they can go down the street and find a good bar, but they're only going to be able to sleep in their hotel. So it's all shifting. Of course, you can at the same time see old behavior among those who haven't shifted yet. Mm. But the shift is happening, and what I'm hoping to do with what we're doing at the Huffington Post and what I'm doing with the book is to help accelerate the shift.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things you've done is you've opened nap rooms at the HuffPost. Tell us about that, and was it difficult to get buy-in at first, to get people to go take a nap, or how did that work?
At first it was met with skepticism. Can you imagine in the middle of a bustling newsroom in the city that never sleeps, people were reluctant to be seen walking into a nap room in the middle of the afternoon. Now they're perpetually full. We are actually opening a third one, and the reason is that people realize that if you haven't gotten enough sleep and you are tired in the middle of the afternoon, having a 20-minute restorative nap is infinitely better than having a third cinnamon bun or a fifth cup of coffee. And after all, if it was good enough for Winston Churchill to win the Second World War, he called them power naps, it should be good enough for us.
So are there limits on nap time? Do you have to get people out of there? Do they go in and not come out for several hours, or how does that work?
It only happened, we have nap rooms in many, we are now in 15 countries, we have nap rooms in many of our offices around the world. In Washington, our Ryan Grimm, our DC bureau chief, had twins. And so what would happen, can you imagine twins, and he already had one child. It was like very hard to get any sleep at night. So sometimes 2 hours would pass and we'd have to knock on the door and say, Ryan, are you okay? But with the exception of, it's mostly incredibly exhausted parents, young parents who have children up all night. No, most of them stay to 20 minutes.
So sleep aids are a big industry unto themselves, over-the-counter, prescription, and so forth. And you talk about some pretty scary side effects from those that maybe people don't realize when they fill those prescriptions.
It's kind of interesting. Sleep aids is a $58 billion global industry. The United States and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world allowed to advertise sleep aids.
Really?
So you see, all these happy people frolicking in beautiful fields while a cheery voice is reading 92 side effects, which include you may get in your car and drive without having a knowledge that you're in your car driving, which I would have thought would be a definite problem for me in terms of trying them. But people are so desperate to sleep and so unaware of how many natural ways there are that they are not afraid to take this very, very risky substance. And you know, we have a lot of cases where people have ended up driving and killing people or hurting people. And in fact, there is such a thing as an ambient defense in law. But, you know, there are a lot of less extreme cases, like Nora Ephron, who was a good friend and an editor at the Huffington Post. Before she died, she was telling me how, and I've included it in the book, she was in Paris and she woke up in the morning and she realized that her hair was wet in the back. And she went to the bathroom and the bathtub was full of water. She had absolutely no memory of turning on the bath, getting in the bathtub, and how easy would it have been for her to drown. So I understand there are times when you may have had a very traumatic experience and that's the only way to go to sleep. But these are times which are few and far between. Now for many people, taking sleeping pills has become a chronic nightly occurrence. And that's really where the problems start.
What about seasons of life, Ariana? We talked about young parents being sleep deprived, but then there's the opposite end of the spectrum. And the conventional wisdom says that the older we get, the less sleep we need. You have women who go through menopause and may have sleep difficulties around hormonal fluctuations. How do we compensate for that on the opposite end of the scale?
So, well, if you look at the data from sleep scientists, there is no real evidence that we need less sleep as we get older. There is a lot of evidence that we need more sleep when we're younger and when we're in our teens. But I think what happens is not that our bodies wake us up or make it hard for us to go to sleep. It's our brains. I mean, I think everybody here can identify with a chattering brain that goes on rehearsing what was done during the day, what we're anxious about for tomorrow. And it's really, we're lying there in bed. It's happened to all of us. It's happened to me. It's happened to everybody in this room, I'm sure. We're lying in bed kind of putting out imaginary fires and rehearsing our lives in the most unproductive way because there's absolutely nothing we can do at that time. So the key in all the transition stages that I recommend in the book, the key is to slow down the brain. And the problem is that most of us don't do that. We literally are going at 100 miles an hour and then we turn off the light and expect the brain to come to a halt, but it doesn't. It needs preparation to come to a halt. And that's why I love reading books that have nothing to do with work. I love reading poetry and philosophy and novels, but I read novels from times when there were no screens, like Jane Austen and Trollope, and, you know, books from another world, because the whole way to go to sleep is to disconnect from our daily lives. If we remain connected, it's very hard to completely allow ourselves to surrender to sleep. And then, you know, I focused more on the performance aspects of sleep, but I think the mystery of sleep is also kind of amazing, and that's why I have a whole section on dreams. I mean, there's just an amazing amount of history around dreams. You know, so many scientists and inventors who came up with their best ideas while sleeping and dreaming. Of course, every religion has dreams as a central part of the way God communicates to with humans. But it's also a time where you literally can let yourself go and say, I don't know what's going to be the movie tonight. And I write down my dreams. I have a little dream book by my bed with a pen, with a flashlight, so you don't have to wake up your partner or even yourself. The less kind of fully awake you are, the more you remember. And it's just amazing, the stuff that comes up our consciousness that we otherwise would not remember if we're sleep deprived.
Is there a difference between men and women as it relates to sleep needs? Maybe who needs more?
Well, women are more affected by sleep deprivation. Like we get angrier, more hostile, I think because we're the more sensitive creatures, what can we do? We are more affected by sleep deprivation.
Well, one of the things, Ariana, that many Americans are losing sleep over these days is the presidential election.
Right.
Curious to hear your thoughts about where we find ourselves at this juncture in the race, and then perhaps we can talk about the candidates and their sleep habits, but let's talk about where your thoughts as to where we are at this point.
So I think that we are at a very dangerous moment, and I feel that the media need to do their job at pointing that out rather than pretending this is a normal election with a normal candidate at the head of the Republican Party. And at the Huffington Post, we're definitely doing our part. From the beginning, we have treated Donald Trump a little bit like we are treating Kim Jong-un, like somebody who is both a buffoon and dangerous at the same time. So we covered him in the entertainment section until the day when he proposed that we ban 1.2 million Muslims, at which point we started covering him as a clear and present danger with a note. If you go to the Huffington Post, every story that includes Trump has a note at the end that's called an editor's note, in which we say we'd like to remind our readers that Donald Trump is a birther, which is stunning. He still believes the president is not legitimate. Wants to ban an entire religion from this country, regularly incites violence, is a serial liar, sexist, and xenophobe. It's our job to point it out. People can vote the way they vote. On top of it, he displays all the symptoms that, according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are the symptoms of chronic sleep deprivation. Because he brags, you know, that he only gets four and a half hours, that he sleeps with his phone, that he tweets in the middle of the night, he regularly retweets Mussolini, for example. And the symptoms are clear, kind of inability to process even simple information. Instability, mood swings, anger outbursts, regurgitation of incomprehensible pablum. It's all there. And so I was on CNN this afternoon when Lindsey Graham decided he will not be endorsing Donald Trump. And I said, good for Lindsey Graham. Good for anybody who is not pretending this is normal. Mm. And that's really our attitude. And, you know, beyond Donald Trump, you know, the idea that sleep deprivation is worn as a badge of honor in the campaign is absurd. Mm-hmm. It's, we were talking earlier about how we used to think that smoking was fine. Remember, there were doctors advertising cigarettes in white coats in the 50s? Now, no politician would ever be seen smoking, even if they do smoke. They would never do it in public. But they are regularly advertising their sleep deprivation. Ted Cruz sent a fundraising letter out 2 weeks ago in which he said, I've sacrificed my health and my sleep for the sake of the country. And I thought to myself, why would we want a sleep-deprived, sick politician as our leader? Like, why? How can this be good? So that's like the delusion that we're living under and the delusion that we are perpetuating to our children. Yeah. And I have in the book a whole section on sleep deprivation and politics, and it didn't used to be that way. I have this amazing story about FDR in 1940 when he was under tremendous pressure to enter the war, but the American public was dead against it. So he didn't know how to square the circle. So what did he do? He took 10 days off, got on a naval ship, and went around the Caribbean to think. And Eleanor was sending him letters saying, so happy to think of you sleeping and refueling. We all need to refuel. If we don't refuel, we're running on empty, and we make dreadful decisions. And the American political system right now is exhibit A of sleep deprivation. And I think if people can reconnect with themselves, make better decisions, amazing things will happen. FDR came out of these 10 days with a political masterpiece, the Lend-Lease program, that allowed America to enter the war with the support of the American people.
Well, on that note, why don't we open it up for your questions, whether they're about sleep or politics or something else.
Hi, Flavia Colgan. Good to see you. Welcome to Philly, Ariana.
Thank you.
I've known you for 16 years, and I've loved watching all of the incarnations, each one purpose-filled and beautiful. This is my personal favorite one, so I'm looking forward to the book. My question for you is, I spend a lot of time in schools with young people, and this is a very big problem, especially for the kids that are high achievers and perfectionists. They think that sleeping less is good. I'm hoping to get them to read the book, but if I can't convince a 17-year-old boy or girl to read the book, could you give me like an elevator pitch, kind of like 1 minute or 30 seconds that I could pour into a kid to let them know how important this is?
Absolutely. First of all, we have a 12-point sleep manifesto that you can give them, and you can even go to my book website, arianahuffington.com, and download it in thousands for them. It basically sums up the tips, but also, especially if they're boys, at that age they really admire athletes, basketball players. So just pick up a few of them who have actually talked publicly. I mean, Andre Iguodala, for example, from the Golden State Warriors. I have a whole section on him because he tracked his sleep and he tracked his stats. And it's just amazing, phenomenal improvement. And I did an interview with him that's on the time.com site in San Francisco, where the Golden State Warriors train. And there is the embarrassing moment when he tried to show me how to play. It did not go well. But other than that, it's just amazing to hear him talk about it passionately. He gets 8 hours. His wife, Christina, whom I met, is religious about it. The temperature that has to be in the room, how dark the room has to be, no screens in the room, no TV in the room. If you have a TV in the room, no problem. Just don't watch it before you go to sleep. You may see Donald Trump. That's scary.
I was wondering if you, in your research or otherwise, had noticed a correlation of benefits in sleeping with a partner or sleeping alone?
Yes. I was having breakfast this morning with Joanna Coles, who is the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, and we decided we have to do a whole piece on that because it's a big problem. So I'm Greek. You may have noticed the accent. And there's an American tradition that makes couples feel that if they don't sleep with each other every night, no matter what, no matter whether their partner snores, kicks them, likes the temperature at 60 degrees while you like it at 70, absolutely no matter what, if you don't sleep with them every night, no matter whether you wake up exhausted in the morning and you want to kill them, it means you don't love them or you're not having sex or whatever. So I think we need to get rid of that delusion too. Basically, it's so important to get a good night's sleep that if for whatever reason, let's say your partner snores, that's the most common complaint. I mean, there are now ways to deal with it. There are some amazing Bose noise-canceling headphones that you can wear, which really help. But let's say I was doing a podcast in LA, and the host, who is also a triathlete, was telling me, I need the temperature to be 60 degrees. My wife needs it to be 70 degrees. He said, it has almost destroyed our marriage. We haven't had sex for years. So he said, fine, we don't have a second bedroom. So he said, finally, I went and built a tent on the terrace. And now he said, our marriage is fantastic. That may seem extreme, but the point is that you need to protect your sleep, whatever it takes. You know, you can still have sex and then go to your separate bedrooms. It's not like it's the two things are not always together. So whatever it takes, if you prioritize your sleep, you'll find ways to actually celebrate your relationship and get enough sleep. And the alternative just doesn't work.
Do you have any tricks for staying asleep? Going to sleep's not a problem, but 4 or 5 hours later, you wake up, and what do you do then?
So first of all, segmented sleep, as it's known, is not a problem. The problem is when you can't fall back asleep. Waking up is not a problem. Can we all be clear about that? It's not. People think that if I don't sleep 8 hours straight, hardly anybody sleeps 8 hours straight. That's not the problem. The reason why we wake up and then have a really hard time going back to sleep is because we have not done the ritual to slow down our brains before we go to sleep. What wakes us up is not our bodies, it's our brains. And then we often do the completely wrong thing and we re-enter our daily life, either because our smartphone is next to us or because we start walking around and doing daily life things. In the olden days, before there was electricity, people would regularly wake up in the middle of the night, but they would never do what they were doing during the day. There were even special prayer books called Prayers for When You Wake Up in the Middle of the Night. So it's basically you need to stay in that other world. And then you're going to go to sleep much more easily. But I also have a lot of help in the book. An entire section of meditations, for example. Even if you don't meditate, it doesn't matter. You can play one of these meditations. They're my favorites. I've listened to hundreds. These are my favorites to put you to sleep. There are two of them that I have never listened to the end. So you're going to find one of them that does it for you. And also I've written one, which my sister, who sounds just like me, has recorded, and it's available for you to download on my website, arianahuffington.com. But when I say download, just in case I haven't made myself clear, I mean download on an iPod, not on a smartphone. Because why? Because the smartphone is going to be in another room, right? So you can get a cheap iPod and make it your sleep iPod. And put meditations, soft music that you may like, anything you want. And I travel a lot. I have a little travel kit that never leaves my carry-on. And it has a sleep iPod, my eye mask, my noise-canceling headphones for the plane, my lavender spray for the plane. If I'm going on a night flight, I even have like a silk pillowcase. You know how hard the pillowcases on planes are? You put it over it. So you create your own little environment wherever you are.
Arianna, I've waited 10 years to ask you this question. The radio journalist, Joe Frank, told the story of a date with you. Have you heard that story? And what are your thoughts? Is it true?
Joe Frank. I might have been sleep deprived, remember. I only started sleeping probably 9 years ago, and that was 10 years ago, right? So I have to plead sleep deprivation.
Statute of limitations has run out on that one. Yes, ma'am.
I have had something puzzling me for years and years, and I maybe you came across some research on this and you'll enlighten me or point me in the right direction. But I wonder always why you're exhausted. One is exhausted. And sometimes when you lie down in bed, you're asleep before you hit the pillow, and that's it. Other times, you're just as tired or even more so, and you lie there and you lie there and you try to empty your mind. And I'm wondering if you know what in the body sends out the signal to all the organs that says, okay, fellas, we're shutting down for the night. What happens to us physically or psychically, and can one bring it about?
Yes, absolutely you can bring it about, because what stops you from sort of surrendering to sleep is really in the brain. And that's why I'm stressing this importance of slowing down the brain, disconnecting the brain from your day life and all the problems and challenges and incompletions. And I don't know if you have a ritual for going to sleep, but the more you're anxious about something, the more critical that ritual becomes. I mean, the more anxious I'm about something, the longer my hot bath becomes. And, you know, and being kind of very religious about it in terms of lowering the lights, darkening the room, having the temperature, I like it at about 67 degrees. So all those things are things that very few people do regularly. And the minute we start doing them, I promise you things change. Your body is exhausted, but your brain stops you from going to sleep. And I would highly recommend you don't watch the nightly news.
When you decided that you had to go to bed earlier and get more sleep, you also had to cut things out of your life and decide to do less. Can you talk about how you went through that process?
Great question. Yes, I cut down House of Cards, for example. We all have much more discretionary time than we think. So that's why I'm saying the most important thing is to be convinced of the importance of sleep. And once you are convinced of how critical it is, how non-negotiable it is, there is a lot of things to cut. Let's say I'm here in Philadelphia. I have good friends who live here. In an ideal world, I would like to have dinner with them tonight. But I have to get up early tomorrow morning. So I'm going right back to get my sleep so that when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to be fully present during my day. Now, this may seem like a sacrifice on the surface, but it's no longer a sacrifice for me because the alternative is walking, going through my day tomorrow sleepwalking, like the Walking Dead. And I don't like that anymore. I mean, I have promised myself that that's not what I'm going to do anymore in my life. Now, like all of us, there are unexpected things that happen that stop you with the best intentions from getting a full night's sleep. And then my goal is, as soon as possible, to get a nap in.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that. And I'm going to come to your question next, ma'am, about the naps. Because one of the things that we hear is don't take a nap if you want to make sure that you sleep well through the night, that naps can disrupt that. So what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, absolutely not. If you're sleep deprived, take a nap. Because it resets your day. And one of the things that happens when we're sleep deprived is we build stress more. And building stress that accumulates in the body is really the enemy of sleep. Because it's much harder to unwind everything. Actually, I say in the book that a good day starts the night before. But also a good night starts the minute you wake up. And just think of it, how most of the world wakes up every morning is with an alarm. Just think of the word, alarm. So before anything has even happened, you are in a fight or flight mode with a cortisone hormone flooding your body. It is completely unnecessary. If you have a good night's sleep and you got enough sleep, you don't need an alarm. You may want to set it as a protection in case, but I always wake up before my alarm and turn it off. And the other thing is that because we said, you know, no smartphones on the nightstand, a lot of people say, how am I going to wake up? A, you can hear it from the next room. B, Pottery Barn has some great-looking alarm clocks, vintage-looking, $32. So there are alternatives.
There are some companies that deal with circadian rhythm kinds of things. I think one of them is called Circadian, and they design shifts and things for places that have to work 24/7. Beyond the airlines, nursing shifts, hospital shifts. The country is 24/7, and most people are not working in shifts that are conducive to what you're talking about. There's some way. Do you see any movement toward that of big organizations, police shifts, nursing shifts, et cetera, trying to design shifts for people that have to work those hours?
So that's a great question. Night shifts are definitely a very difficult way to get a good night's sleep if you're on a night shift. I think what is important is, first of all, to make the night shift sustainable, not the way often in hospitals they have people have not just night shifts but ridiculously long shifts. And then to make sure that you get a good night's sleep during the day. And that requires having a completely dark room. That requires prioritizing your sleep. But in an ideal world, people would not have night shifts all their lives, because it definitely has an impact on their health. So, you know, if you're on a night shift for a few years, it's kind of ideal not to be on a night shift forever.
I'm a college student, and I know in high school I barely got any sleep, especially in my junior year, because I would wake up really early for school, and then I would have a lot of homework or after-school activities or sports, and not be able to sleep because I was up really early and staying up really late at night. And I know a lot of high school students feel like they can't control that because of the way that school works and the way that school times are set. So I just was wondering if you have any ideas for what schools can do to help students get better sleep. Like, do schools need to have nap times like how the companies do?
So, first of all, thank you so much. That's such an important question. I feel particularly strongly as the mother of two daughters who've recently graduated from college that this is a demographic we need to reach so your generation doesn't suffer from collective delusions about sleep the way our generation has. And that's why we've done this long college tour. But also in high schools, there is a movement that is absolutely fantastic called the Start School Later movement, because teenagers have a different circadian rhythm, and asking teenagers to get up at 7 to be ready and functioning is like asking me to get up at 4 a.m. Yeah. So we need to change that. One of the problems is that kids are misdiagnosed with ADD, especially kids in elementary school, because when we are tired, we kind of look tired, we act tired. When children are tired, they often become more rambunctious, and it's even harder for them to pay attention, and the symptoms are very similar to ADHD. So it starts that vicious cycle. So there is a big movement now. It's growing. We're doing everything we can at the Huffington Post to highlight it and spread it. And in terms of colleges, I'd love you to go on the Huffington Post to have dozens of blog posts from college students who've changed their habits. And they're beautiful pieces. I mean, really moving pieces about how it's changed their whole life. It's changed their health, their relationships, their skin, their weight, their grades. Everything is better. Just go for the hashtag Sleep Revolution. We have amazing stuff on social media that they've been doing. If you go on my Instagram or my Facebook, or just put that hashtag in. So this is like for us a whole cultural shift happening among high school and college students. And I'm just delighted that you're interested in that. I'd love to invite you to write about it yourself. I know who you are. You are Tracy's daughter, Danielle. So I'd love you to invite your fellow students at Penn to write about it. We actually have some great pieces from Penn students already on the Huffington Post. But the whole idea is to help that movement spread and basically create a critical mass. And once we create a critical mass, it's going to seem as bizarre to people that we lived our way this way, as it now seems bizarre to us that we're glamorizing smoking. So sleep deprivation is the new smoking. And the sooner your generation especially gets the message, the happier, healthier, and more productive your lives are going to be.
Wow. Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Please join me in thanking Arianna Huffington. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.